Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
Silverstone was a circuit I always loved and went well at, and I know it so well because I worked there as an instructor at the race school, and I lived in Brackley, and it was baking hot in terms of the track temperature. It was into the sort of mid to high 30s. You know, I still think back to that day of the car was just so good. You know, you don't get that type of race anymore where you can push like hell all the way through in F2.
Those are the words of former Formula One driver turned broadcaster Karun Chandhok describing his thoughts on the 2008 GP2 feature race at Silverstone, where he finished third for iSport International. This event is the subject of a special episode of our Race of My Life mini-series. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and as I'm sure you've guessed from that introduction, I'm joined on today's episode by Karun himself. So Karun, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm very well, and thanks for having me.
It's very exciting to just to do a quite a different format for a Race of My Life, because as my second guest that I'm about to introduce in a moment, Autosport's chief editor Kevin Turner will explain, Karun hasn't done a Race of My Life before, so it's effectively a live recording and a live description of why you pick that certain race.
Yeah, I think we're effectively restarting Race of My Life again, aren't we? So it first came out in 1988 and lasted about 5 years then. And obviously I've been going through all the old magazines and picking out some good ones, and that's what we've been doing in this series. We brought it back in about 2009 and did it for another 8 or 9 years. And this is the first of Generation 3. Karun, no copy to look up or copy up. So I'm quite looking forward to just hearing Karun's thoughts on the races. Although, of course, it does mean that one of us has to go away and write it up afterwards, which normally we've already done by this point.
And I believe you volunteered for that.
I think I foolishly did do that, yeah.
Yes, you did. You did. I did say that I would help you out, and then I realised actually that that there were certain elements that would make it slightly a shorter job, so therefore one person should handle it all, take charge, and I thought there could be no better person than the chief editor to do that.
How very convenient.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? It's funny that, isn't it? Right. Well, let's get into the race. 2008 Silverstone GP2. It's still the sort of the first generation. Was it the first generation of GP2 car, Karun, that they were using?
No. It was the second one. It was we switched over in 2008 actually to the second generation car.
And it's quite a dramatic one for you. You'd qualified 10th, but end up on the podium. With you were Giorgio Pantano, race winner, eventual champion that season, and your future Formula One and Formula E rival, Lucas Di Grassi. What are your memories of that event? I guess we'll start off with there.
It actually starts from the day before in qualifying. I think we've been a Magni Cor before that, and I was teammates with Bruno that year. And he was on a good run of races, especially in qualifying. He'd won in Monaco, qualified in the front row, qualified on pole at Magni Cor. And then, you know, so I was getting a little bit on the back foot and a bit annoyed at my own qualifying, because in both of those three races, I had the sectors, but I got traffic or I made mistakes, and it was a bit of a tough time. But Silverstone was a circuit I always loved and went well at. And I know it so well because I worked there as an instructor at the race school, and I lived in Brackley and raced in British F3, so it was effectively my adopted home circuit, and I was really pumped up for it. And in qualifying, I was on a very good lap, and got held up coming. I still remember I came through bridge flat, and then as I turned left into, well, it was the old bridge corner, and then turned left into Priory, Andy Suchek was basically trundling along at the apex, and so I had to abort the lap, and I wouldn't have qualified, Bruno, but I think I was on course to be sort of P4, which would have been better than my recent qualifying. So I was furious. I remember coming into the pits, aborted the lap, came in, and and as soon as I came in, I jumped out of the car and actually started running down the pit lane with my helmet on, and started giving Andy a mouthful. To his credit, he actually immediately apologized, which sort of disarmed me, because at that point I was like, oh, I'm there, sort of ready for a fight. And he just straight away apologized, and I didn't know what to do at that point. But I remember the next day, it was baking hot in terms of the track temperature. It was into the sort of mid to high 30s, which was higher than it had been for qualifying. And my race engineer, Richard Selwyn, said to me, he says, how about we try a softer rear spring? Because it felt like it was going to be a race where we were going to be tire limited. And with the Bridgestones back then, it, you know, tire deg wasn't a conversation that you had as much as we do in the Pirelli era. You know, it was part of the conversation, but it was part of a bigger conversation you had on setup, not one that you really focus on. But that day, we sort of looked at the ambient and thought, yeah, this could be a day where tire deg's an issue. And I remember we changed the rear spring. We went for a softer rear spring, and Bruno didn't want to do it. He sort of thought about it and went, no, I'm happy where he's at. And that was one of the key decisions that helped me out. But yeah, it was, you know, I started 10th, as you said, and I made a couple of places off the start, but I had really good pace. And I remember I passed Suchek around the outside of Stowe.
Bit of revenge there. Nice.
Yeah, which was quite nice. And then picked my way up. And I think before the pit stop, I'd sort of settle into fifth. And, you know, the field that year was, 2008 was a particularly strong year. You know, if you actually look at the list, you had and you look at where those drivers have gone. Obviously, you mentioned, you know, Pantano, Degrassi, Senna. You know, we have Grosjean, Petrov, Maldonado, Buemi. You know, some really, really quality drivers that season. And I remember I jumped Bruno. I think I stayed out a lap longer than Bruno, and I jumped him at the pit stop. And then passed Grosjean around the outside into Stowe, which was pretty cool. But then I suddenly realized I passed him, and as I came out, there was a yellow flag on the outside because somebody had pinned it. So then I had to brake and let him pass again. and then got past, I think it was at Brooklands. I dived down the inside over the curb, and we banged wheels.
That was a pretty dramatic moment, that one. I was watching the video this morning, and that's quite a, oh, is there enough room? Oh, yeah, that was quite...
Yeah. Needed a little bit of... needed a bit of cooperation from Roman. But yeah, the car was mega that day. And I remember it was just... I still think back to that day of... The car was just so good to drive. And it was one of those where, you know... what was cool is that my engineer, as I said, gave me the... only a couple of years ago, he gave me my folder from 2008 with all of my run sheets and setup sheets and information from that day, and I've got it here in front of me. And this is something you don't see nowadays, right? You know, I think the second lap of the race, I did a 33.1, and the last lap of the race was a 33.5. And okay, there were a few laps in between with 32s and things like that. But, you know, you don't get that type of race anymore where you can push like hell all the way through an F2 or an F1 just because of the tire deck.
Well, I was looking up the Autosport report, which is by Charles Bradley. He did a report on that, and he described he said that you were setting sensational times in clean air, because obviously you did have to keep coming up to people and over.
Well, Karun, as we've got you here, you helpfully supplied us with a list of races that, well, first of all, that you were very clear on what your Race of My Life pick was going to be, but then other ones that you could have potentially had it, or you do have in the pot as well. So rather than debating what you could have picked, I figured we'd just, it sounded like a good idea to run through your other great drives, what you consider to be your best drives. If we can start with quite an early one, your first ever race in 2000 in the Indian National Racing Championship. And your notes when you sent this over was good luck researching that. So I didn't. I thought I'd leave it all up to you to explain exactly what happened there.
I came down Hangar Strait. I could see them getting closer and closer to me. And I thought I needed four or five more laps, really, because my tyres were still in good nick at that point.
Now, obviously, 2008 is your year on the Red Bull Junior program, and the Silverstone podium comes not long after you'd also got a feature race podium at Monaco. What was the reaction of Helmut Marko? I guess must be a commonly asked question, but yeah, what was at that point going on with Red Bull?
I don't remember seeing Helmut, to be honest. It was a funny one because, you know, obviously I was, as you said, I was a Red Bull Junior at the time, but I'd been on quite a good run of races, to be honest, that year. Obviously, I hadn't won anything yet, but there have been circumstances. I think in Catalonia, I was running fourth and then had to queue behind Bruno at the pit stop. Istanbul, I finished fourth. Monaco, as you say, I was third. Magny-Co was a bad weekend. So in terms of pace, I was in decent shape, but I was very much the second favorite Red Bull Junior in GP2 that season. You know, Buemi was was Helmut's boy. He, I remember, I think it was the previous year in Monza, I remember, I had the rear suspension fail and I'd started way down. I can't remember, it may have even been last, but anyway, I started way down and Buemi was with ART, a top team. I was with Durango, a team who finished last the previous year. And I went from P nowhere to finishing, I think I finished fifth or sixth in the feature race, coming through the pack. And I passed Buemi along the way. And I went to see Helmut afterwards. And the only thing he said to me was, didn't Buemi do well today in the race? And I was just like, well, I don't know what to say at this point.
His loss. But of course, this being GP2, there was another race the next day. Sadly, didn't quite go so well. So what happened in the sprint race, Karun?
I clearly remember I came out of club and it was absolutely pouring rain, very different conditions to the day before. And I came out of club and accelerating out and I couldn't see a thing. I got very close to the car in front. I can't remember who it was. It may have been Lucas. But I was right in the toe of the car front and hit a puddle, which put me slightly offline onto the exit curve. And as soon as I touched the curb on the left-hand side, just broke traction, spun across the track into the barrier. So, out on lap one. So, yeah, it was a big crash back down to earth after the day.
Many people crashed that day, though, didn't they? In the F1 race as well as the.
Well, this is it. Yeah, I mean, when you look back now, and you know, I can't believe it's 12 years later, but actually, the conditions on that 2008 Sunday were one of the worst ever, weren't they? When you look at Lewis's race later that day, obviously everyone remembers that, but we raced, you know, a couple of hours before in those same conditions and it was horrendous. So the other thing that I remember after that Silverstone 2008 race was Ginny Williams, Sir Frank's late wife. I'd given her a copy of a book she'd written called A Different Kind of Life, one of the best motorsport books, I think, that's out there and was the inspiration for the Williams film. And I got an original copy and I'd given it to her months before. And soon after the Silverstone race, she signed it for me and sent it back and it's still sitting on the bookshelf behind me. And she's written in there, I really enjoyed watching your race at the weekend. Very well done. It was a really, you know, a really nice note to me. Because Jonathan was actually a part shareholder of iSport and, you know, he was very much part of the team. And so that's one of my nice little mementos, actually, from the 2008 race. I mean, I've obviously got the trophy, but that's another nice little memento to have from that weekend.
Well, Karun, as we've got you here, you helpfully supplied us with a list of races that, well, first of all, that you were very clear on what your Race of My Life pick was going to be, but then other ones that you could have potentially had it, or you do have in the pot as well. So rather than debating what you could have picked, I figure we just, it sounded like a good idea to run through your other great drives, what you consider to be your best drives. If we can start with quite an early one, your first ever race in 2000 in the Indian National Racing Championship. And your notes when you sent this over was good luck researching that. So I didn't. I thought I'd leave it all up to you to explain exactly what happened there.
So yeah, 2000 was, I just turned 16. And I think by now, because Simon Lazenby has tweeted the photo so many times, everyone realizes I was a bit of a fat kid in my teenage years. I peaked at 96 kilos. And at the start of 2000, at that time, that was the age you could get a racing license in India when I was 16. And we also had no karting, so I never did a go-kart race in my life. Now, I should probably give you a bit of context because, you know, back in India, my dad was one of the most well-known racing and rally drivers. My grandfather founded the ASN and sort of co-founded the circuit in India. So we have a long history of in India motorsport. And I grew up at the racetrack and going to rallies. So and there was a lot of conversations over the years about when are you going to get started? When are you going to get started? And so it came to 2000. I was like, right, this is it. This is my big chance. My dad looked at me and went, yeah, you need to lose a bit of weight. This is, you know, this is not happening. And so from January until June, I went on a mega lifestyle change basically. And I probably lost about 15 kilos by June, and by October, I lost 26 kilos across that year. So anyway, I got to June, and that was when the first race of the of the season was. And I qualified on pole, muffed up the start, was running second all the way through, and then overtook a person called Kamlesh Patel, who actually used to race and rally against my dad. And I remember watching them when I was a kid. And I overtook him on the last lap to win the race. So, you know, it's obviously the level of racing and the levels of the cars. This was a saloon car called a Maruti Esteem, which is sort of like a Suzuki Swift. You know, the level is nothing like what I experienced further up the chain. But for me, it was a really important day because I'd been dreaming of waiting to be a racing driver because I could never go any karting. That was my first ever chance to actually go racing. And, you know, there was obviously, because it was the Indian national championship, there was local media and press and all that sort of stuff. So it was, it was a big day that sort of set me up on this journey.
Had you been able to do much testing of the car before then? Because that's quite impressive if you've not done any karting or anything before then to beat someone that's obviously got experience at motorsport. So how much running had you had?
Yeah, no, I'd been driving and testing for a while before. And I was actually meant there was a one-off race they used to have in January, February or something as a one-off before the championship. And I had to pull out of there because I got chicken pox. So I'd actually been testing and preparing for that and then basically ended up with another 3 or 4 months to do a bit more practice.
Well, your next pick, Karun, is going from the start right to the pinnacle of motorsport. It's the 2010 European Grand Prix at Valencia, where you're racing for HRT. Qualified 23rd, finished 18th. Two laps down in the final results, but ahead of Timo Glock, Bruno Senna and Jarno Trulli. So yeah, what are your standout memories of that weekend?
It's funny, isn't it? You when you listen to the stats, you finished 18th. How on earth could that be a contender for the race of your life? But I always say to people in this sport, you know, you're racing against your circumstances. And we were very much we weren't in the B category, we were the C category of everyone at that stage. But we had six of us in there. HRT was very much the third of those teams. We had no real chance to compete with those guys on pace. But I remember going to Valencia, and that was a circuit I was always pretty comfortable at, and I enjoyed it when we raced there in GP2. And I think that weekend I was generally on good form compared to Bruno. I qualified him, I remember, by 2 or 3 tenths. I was ahead of him all the way through. And I worked really hard with the engineers because it's a circuit which puts a lot of emphasis on braking stability. And you need the front end to be stable as much as, and you need the whole car really to be as stable as possible on the braking. And with the HRT, we had this problem where the front wing would stall once you got over a certain point. And therefore, braking stability was a particular problem. And I had my systems engineer, a guy called Angel Baena, who's now at McLaren doing a very good job there. And he'd worked with Kubica before that at BMW. And I remember the morning of FP3, we set up all of these maps for the engine braking and for, just getting the car with the diff and the engine braking maps, trying to build in a bit of stability. And we did a really good program of just playing with the switches every lap. And then we constructed this this range of maps that we could use. And, for me, there's a lot of satisfaction I get from working with the engineers because, listen, this is a team sport. And I think that's part of what makes a good race is the fact that you've built up to it and prepared for it and given yourself a chance. I ended up qualifying Bruno by 2 or 3 tenths, and all the way through the race, I remember the engineer just giving me the gaps and talking on the radio, and I just gently pulled away from him. And I think I ended the race over 30 seconds ahead of him at the end, which was pretty cool, really. For me, that was the only reference. You know, you're only racing really your teammate, a couple others. Timo had an issue, I remember, and so ended up behind us. But then towards the end, he wasn't catching me. My pace was good enough, and actually, he ended up between Bruno and me. So the fact that I had the pace to extend the gap over Bruno meant that I finished ahead of Timo. So in our own little battle, in our own little way, that was it was a good race for me.
You actually outqualified Bruno by half a second, I think, in that one. So you've done yourself out of a couple of tenths. But I think because Glock and Senna, I think, had a bit of a clash at some point during the pit stop phase. Not quite sure exactly what it was.
It was later on. I think they clashed because I remember I was already ahead of them, and my engineers came on the radio. I still remember them saying, "Timo's got ahead of Bruno, and this is the gap to him." So. I think I remember it was somewhere on track, but I was ahead of them both by that point.
Yeah. And then he caught you at the end. I think he got you on the last lap and then got a penalty to drop you out behind again because he'd had a blue flag infringement or something.
There was something there. They said to me on the, because yes, that's it. They said, don't fight him because he's got a penalty. The engineer said he's coming, but don't fight him. He's got a penalty coming. So yeah. It's been 10 years, but it's slowly coming back to me now.
Well, I just thought I'd throw this at you, which is your driver ratings in Autosport magazine for this particular race from Autosport's former Grand Prix editor, Ed Straw, who I know you know well. He gave you a 7 out of 10 and described it as a solid race. Do you have any response to that?
Well, I mean, I had to point out to Ed Straw the other day that when he wrote the Autosport end of season review, he wrote that I was the pick of the HRT drivers, the plethora of drivers who took part this season, which coming from Straw is quite a compliment, really, because you know I've normally got to drag them out of his mouth.
I think that is quite interesting though, but I think that's one of the reasons why it's nice to hear the drivers say what their races are, because. Obviously, as journalists, we're always trying to identify who's done a good job, but it's much harder when you've got people, you know, in the midfield or further back where the cars aren't on the pace. You know, lots of people remember the races that are the wins or the championships or the podiums.
Yeah,
but I remember, you know, Jackie Stewart saying to me that there were races he won where he knows he didn't do a very good job, and other races where he finished fourth or whatever, and he drove much better. So I think that the drivers know when they've done a good job, don't they? Irrespective of where they finish, because as you say, it's so machinery orientated.
That's right. I mean, I was listening to Heikki Kovalainen's podcast he's done on the F1 channel, and it's interesting. He picks he doesn't pick his race win at Budapest as being one of his best races. And he's actually picked the ones that he did with Lotus Caterham, which were P Nowhere, as his best race of his career. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I think I got Straw back at the next weekend, I remember, in at Silverstone, because he fell through the floor of the HRT motorhome off his chair, which was a particularly funny sight.
Didn't the leg went straight through the floor, didn't it, or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go slightly back in time in terms of the chronological order of these picks, but it's just one season back to GP2 2009 Monaco sprint race. You qualified second for Ocean Racing, but it's your start and your move on Pastor Maldonado, who's on pole. You sweep around the outside of Sandoval into the lead, charge off, and then heartbreak at the end with a mechanical failure. So, Karun, what are your memories of that race?
It still remains the biggest disappointment of my professional career as a racing driver, not winning that race. You know, I'd been on good form all weekend. That I really enjoy Monaco to drive. It's always been a strong circuit for me. But qualifying was a nightmare that year at Monaco with the traffic. And I never just didn't get a lap. Didn't get a clear lap. You know, nowadays these guys get the split groups, so they've only got 10 cars on track at a time. At that point, we were 26 of us all trying to make space. And every time I seemed to come around, there was a traffic jam at Rascas. And so I actually ended up 10th on the grid for the feature race. But I knew I had so much more pace. And so I said to my engineer, I said, right, what we're going to do is we're going to pit on lap 6 when the pit stop window opens and just pray that nobody else pits and we can get some track position. And I pitted and I was, when I turned in, I saw a clear path in front of me. Nobody else from the cars ahead had pitted, and behind me two or three others came. And so when I came out, I came into free air and I nailed 4 or 5 laps with purple sectors and fastest laps. And that allowed me to make up, you know, 3 places and get to 7th on that race. And after, you know, I drove around in traffic so much below the potential of the car. I knew, okay, on the Sunday, when I've got a chance to get up front, it'll be good. And I still remember on the formation lap, I remember saying to myself, okay, do a couple of extra burnouts, because even if the rear tires get too hot for later on, it doesn't matter. You've got to have the launch off the start. I knew if I had to get past it off the start. I did a couple of extra burnouts, went up the grid box, and my start was mega. It was, I still remember, it was a 2.15 from 0 to 100K, which was the best start by far I'd done all year. They'd resurfaced the grid as well that year, so it was a higher grip. And I remember looking at that on the Saturday, thinking, you know, I sort of clocked that and thought, you got to adjust the clutch bite point in the map. And so I got the data engineer to adjust the clutch map and really focused a lot of energy on that start. And I jumped past her, as you said, got ahead. And then I was in the rhythm. It was just one of those days where I just felt you know, infallible. Nothing could distract me. Nothing could break my concentration. And I was, you know, I pulled away 2.5-3 seconds over Pastor, who was actually a bit of a Monaco specialist, wasn't he?
I was just going to say he was really quick round there, and the two of you completely checked out. Like he sort of kept you within a sort of a, as you say, like a couple of seconds or whatever. But you left the rest of the field behind, so you must have been on another level on that day.
Yeah, I mean, I remember because my engineer was obviously telling me the gap to Pastor, but I remember at one point that I saw Pastor's pit board, and it showed something like plus 14 to D'Ambrosio. And I suddenly thought, wow, we're miles ahead of Jerome. And I think Hulkenberg was behind him, and there was a bit of queue there. And yeah, we were on a different league. And then when I came out of the last corner, Anthony knows, I put the power down and just felt a lack of acceleration. And the drive shaft had gone. And subsequently, you know, I have to remember that year, Ocean Racing Technology was a new team. And I think later on, they told me that what happened was they'd replaced one of the drive shafts for that weekend, you know, going into the weekend, or going maybe even going to that race. But normally when you change drive shafts, you need to change both at the same time, because it's one of those things that has to work in sync. And you know, that's basically what happened. The drive shaft failed. And I think it was Mark Glendening was the Autosport GP2 man at the time. And he came to see me afterwards. And I said, I'm glad I'm talking to you today, Mark, because tomorrow I'm going to have an enormous hangover after the amount of tequila I'm going to drink tonight to make me feel better.
Absolutely, and it's because it's Monaco. It's so difficult to get a win in any category there. I can remember when I covered Formula 2 in 2017, Charles Leclerc's season there, rookie season where he won. And obviously, he's from Monaco. He was with Prema. He was on pole position. He looked like he was going to win the feature race. Had a couple of problems, and then eventually, mechanical drama drops him out. And you could just sense in his description of it when I spoke to him, it was like, I might never get another chance to win at Monaco. And that's just why it's extra tough to hear. So obviously now he's at Ferrari, probably it'll be very surprising if he doesn't end up with a home win, who knows. But yeah, for any driver, once you've got a chance to win at Monaco, it must add that extra little bit of heartache for you.
The only trophy in my living room is the one from third place in Monaco in 2008. And, you know, I keep it in here for two reasons. One is obviously I'm very proud to have gone to the Royal Box in Monaco and got a trophy. But second, it's actually a reminder to me of you know, how you can't take anything for granted. And, you know, it reminds me of 2009 and the one that got away. So, yeah, it's that hurt. And if I'm perfectly honest, even just talking about it makes it still hurts a bit.
Oh, we don't want to inflict pain, Karun. But just on what you said, I think that Monaco does hold something special for drivers generally because of the challenge, particularly in a modern context. Obviously, as time's gone on, more and more tracks have, you know, got runoff, et cetera, et cetera. And we spoke to Mika Häkkinen recently, and he had obviously a number of races that he wanted to talk about and you could pick out from his career. But he said the win at Monaco in 1998 in terms of the driving level that he got to was the highest because the margins were so, small. So to be in the zone leading a race for so long without making a mistake was kind of peak driver performance, really. Everything else was benchmarked against.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's such small differences as well, because it's actually, you know, the lap is only, even in GP2 at the time, it was only a minute 20 or so. So it's quite, you know, it's quite a short lap. It's intense. Your heart rate is off the chart. I mean, I still think, my memory is still pretty good. I remember 2008, for example, the only reason Bruno got to the front row and I didn't was on my lap, I went to third gear for Tabak instead of fourth, because I didn't quite think I had enough grip. And then it turned out I did. And that was the difference between Bruno and me. He was second on the grid, I was sixth. And after that, I never got another lap, because you just keep getting traffic. You know, it's at that time with the 26 cars, you only ever got one lap of qualifying. You had to be so wired in and plugged in for that lap when it counted. It's an amazing challenge. So I hope I can at least go back with the historics or something like that, because it's still a track that I just love driving at.
We'll see if we can sort that out. We'll have to see who's got a car that we can get you into.
Yeah, well, I've been pushing Williams, obviously, with the heritage stuff, because we went and did a demo there, and that was pretty mega. And I said to Jonathan, I said, "Well, yeah, it'd be quite nice to come back and have a little race in a Keke Rosberg FW08. So I've planted the seed, Kev. But yeah, maybe plant a few more around.
Yeah, helpful. Okay, cool. That sounds like a good idea.
Well, from one race at a legendary motorsport racetrack to another one, Karun, your final pick on your list is the 2013 Le Mans 24 Hours, where you're racing for Murphy in the Orica alongside Brendan Hartley and Mark Patterson. Now, you finished 12th overall and 6th in LMP2. So what are your memories of that race, and why is it so particularly special?
To be honest, it's not the race on the whole, but I'm actually going to almost call this a stint of my life, because, you know, Le Mans, it feels like being a race anyway, each one of those quadruples. But there was a stint where I've got the result sheet up here, and I got in the car at 2:40 in the morning and got out at 6:20 in the morning. So it was a pretty marathon, you know, 3 hours, 40 minutes in the car. And it was a really tough stint in the dark, because it had started raining at certain parts of the track. So the bit around the pits was generally dry. But as you went down the Mulsanne straight and you came out of the first chicane, the track started to get wet. And then by the time you got down to Mulsanne Corner and Indianapolis, it was really quite wet. And then, you know, through the Porsche curves, damp, and it started to dry up again. So it was one of those nightmare scenarios, because at night you can't tell the difference in the color of the tarmac as well as, well, you really can't tell the difference like you can in the daytime. So when you've got the situation where a part of the track's dry and the part of the track's wet and you can't tell which one's which, it's quite a challenge. So choosing the right tire became massively critical. And I did one lap on the slicks, and I thought, oh, it's getting a bit hairy, but it's not, you know, if I was on the wets, we'll just overheat and cook it. And I said to the engineer, I said, okay, let's try inters, because it's a really soft compound, so I'll look after it in the dry bits, and then at least I'll have something underneath me with a bit of tread for the damp parts. And at that point, we had to roll the dice. We'd lost, I think Mark had been off into the gravel of the Porsche curves, and we lost, I know, a chunk of time. And then we had an ECU issue. It cost us two laps as well early on. So we were on the back foot. And so I thought, okay, we'll roll the dice and let's just see what happens. And there were times where I remember the engineer said, you're 10 seconds faster than the class leader on some laps. You know, I made a lap back on the pack. I remember having a good battle with Marino Franchitti, who's my friend who now lives 3 miles away from me, funnily enough. But I remember having a good battle with him, and he was with level five at that point. And I passed him on the outside going into the fast ride of Indianapolis, which was pretty hairy. And I think there were only, I can't remember how many cars were running at that point, but, you know, let's say 50 odd cars running. And there were only three of us who chose the intermediates at that stage. It was Marc Genet, I think, was in the Audi with the LMP1, myself, and I think it was one of the GT cars. And we all just made, you know, there was a period of time where we just got chunks of time back. My other memory of that stint was there was a safety car because a car had gone into the barrier at the Dunlop curves, and it got, I think it damaged the barrier. So at this point, I'd been in the car for a while and it's raining, and this was still the open top cars. So I'm now under safety car getting rained on. So I'm drenched. I'm freezing cold. I've drunk a load of fluid because I think, you know, I've got a marathon quadruple stint coming on. So I remember doing the last two stints just desperate to pee. But Brendan was very grateful that I held off and didn't do a Nelson Piquet on him.
I did actually have an extra question for Kurin, actually, because obviously he was a big fan of motorsport before he became a driver, and obviously has become a successful pundit subsequently. So is there a favourite race you've seen as a fan that stands out to you?
Yeah, there's so many, isn't there? I think when you look at F1, I mean, the one that immediately jumps to mind, 87 British Grand Prix, Mansell hunting down Piquet. That's the first one. I think of Brazil 2008, you know, amazing championship decider. I think of Jerez 97. I think 97 is actually one of the most underrated F1 seasons.
Controversial.
There's probably a few more. Oh, Suzuka 2005, of course. That's an incredible one, isn't it?
But you wouldn't have been defending thin air as early as
I mean, was he doing? Come defending into the chicane, you know. That is, yeah. You just think he just set himself up to fail there. Well, also, he was obviously asleep, wasn't he, for most of the race, because, you know, he had a 20-second lead at one point and just underestimated the pace Fernando and Kimi had.
Yeah, he was. I think his fastest lap was like 3/4 of a second or a second off of Alonso's in the same car. And you're like, you should have been in range of Kimi getting to
exactly.
You. What was going
exactly.
on?
Well, Kurin, as Kev said there, your career with Sky Sports F1 as a broadcaster will be not restarting, but continuing in a couple of weeks when finally the 2020 Formula One season gets going. So, first of all, how excited are you about F1 finally coming back, considering all the challenges that every society has faced, motorsport as well, has obviously been shut down by the coronavirus pandemic? And, you know, what are your thoughts about the season finally starting? It feels like many, many years ago that you and I walked around the track at Barcelona and had a look at the cars.
We've missed it, haven't we? I think we've missed seeing cars on track. We've missed seeing racing. You know, there's a real appetite for watching live sport and watching live Formula One again. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, the indications from testing were that Ferrari seemed slightly on the back foot. I think Red Bull are cautiously optimistic that they're going to be closer to Mercedes. Let's look at, historically, the Red Bull Ring has been a great track for them in recent years, isn't it? With Max getting those two wins in the last few years. So I think there's with the first two weekends there, that could set us up with a good start to the season. And there's lots of subplots, isn't it? You know, the fact that now Seb is leaving Ferrari, how much is he really going to make the effort this season? Or on the flip side, is he one of these drivers who thinks, you know what, I'm going to dig deep and go the extra mile to show them what they're going to miss after I'm gone this year? I think that'll be, I mean, can you imagine if he ends up being top dog at Ferrari this year? How's that going to play out in the long term? So I think there's lots of subplots up and down the grid. You know, Racing Point are going to be massively excited because they not only are going to get the benefit of that car for this year, but also now for next season. So that's certainly going to upset the likes of McLaren and Renault and people who don't feel that car is 100% within the spirit of the rules. But fair play to Racing Point. They've absolutely ticked every FIA box, and I'd do that if I was them. So lots of sub-stories.
I think spirit of the rules, that's not really a thing, is it? When you've got that many clever people with that amount of resources, it's their job to find the loopholes in the written rules, not worry about the spirit of the rules.
Exactly. There's a quote from Colin Chapman that I wrote down saying, rules are for the interpretation of wise men and the obedience of fools. And, you know, he obviously pushed the boat on that, didn't he?
Absolutely. And people like Adrian Newey do as well. I remember Red Bull arguing quite strenuously about the definition of what a hole was a few years ago as well with one of the cars. So, yeah, it's if it's not illegal, it's legal, isn't it, at this stage?
It is. And what a great feeling it is just to be arguing and talking and hearing about such little intricate F1 politics and F1, you know, technical details. That sounds like normality to me, I think, which would be nice after a little while.
We've got two good storyline alternatives, haven't we? Hopefully Red Bull can win one of those first two or three races and as Kieran says, put a fight up against Mercedes, because it does look like Ferrari are perhaps slightly off it. But if they don't and Hamilton starts off, starts with a couple of wins or whatever, then you're immediately into, well, he's closing in on the Schumacher records, and there's that kind of interest to get into and comparisons and when will he do it, you know? So I'd prefer the former, because I think we all want close racing, but there should be some interesting storylines and whatever happens, I think.
Indeed. And Karim, one last thing really, just on Lewis, because the way that 2020 has played out has actually almost changed for him more than anyone else, perhaps, what this championship could be. Because just say, obviously we don't hope that this happens, but just say that there are only 8 or 10 Formula One races in the season that can go ahead. Say he still wins the title and it's his 7th Formula One world title, he equals Michael Schumacher. People will already be, and I'm sure, because he has his many detractors for numerous, some of them not very wonderful reasons, that the people suggesting that it would be like an asterisk next to the Schumacher equaling title. So it's kind of an interesting one to consider Hamilton's season ahead of it, about how different it will be now that coronavirus has sort of chopped what we thought was going to happen in half.
I've had lots of thoughts about this actually, as I've been out cycling on my own, just trying to think what would be my own acceptable number for this being a proper world championship. I sort of land on 12 being the number that I feel comfortable with. You know, I know people will immediately say, you know, well, Jim Clark and stuff, you know, and Fangio raced with races which were single digits that made up a world championship, and I know that, but I think that times have changed, car reliability has changed, you know, the way people go racing has changed. The whole sport has changed to the point where I think we're used to seeing a world championship across a certain number of races. I don't think we're going to get 15 or 18, but I think if we get to 12, then to me, that seems like a very, very good case for whoever wins it to be, you know, the world championship to be as highly rated as any other year. That's, and I think, you know, if we look at it, we've got 8 announced in Europe. I could see another 1 or 2 coming along, isn't it? There's rumors of Mugello and Hockenheim and all these places. One of those I could see happening. I could see 2 in Bahrain, 1 in Abu Dhabi, potentially. So, you know, that'll get us 12, even if we don't do that, you know, that chunk of races of Asia, North America, which, you know, I know there's lots of negotiations and I saw stories about potential Chinese doubleheader, stuff like that. But even without that, I think we should be able to get to 12.
I think it's worth remembering as well that one of the strengths that we've talked about with Lewis Hamilton before is his ability to maintain a very high level across a long season. In fact, I think Bottas himself has said it's so hard to keep that going through a whole year. So you could argue that a shorter season takes out one of perhaps Lewis's strengths and plays into the hands of some of the others. And Mercedes traditionally are quite good at developing their car during a long campaign. They usually finish quite strongly, so they won't have quite the same. So I'd certainly still regard a championship win in these circumstances as being a worthy one. You've still got to beat the same opposition, but with perhaps greater restrictions than they had before. And I don't think I think we're well past the point now where you have to have Lewis Hamilton in the debate up there with Mark Schumacher and Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost and Jim Clark, Jackie Stewart, all those people anyway. So, I don't think it'll be, I don't think it'll be a big, stain on his name or CV if he was to win a championship in a shortened season.
No, I agree. And, you know, I'm never one for purely looking at statistics, you know. Statistically, Jim Clark is far behind a lot of other drivers in terms of absolute championships and wins. Yet in my book, he is still the number one. You know, I still think Clark was the best Formula One driver in history. And I think, so you can't just look at the stats, really.
Absolutely. Well, I think we should end this podcast by just returning to what we discussed at the beginning, the 2008 Silverstone GP2 feature race, Karun. I just wanted, as we're doing this podcast, well, as a podcast, it's going to be a feature on autosport.com as well. What, you know, it's great to be able to have the person we're doing it with live ahead of everything for the first time. I just wondered, when did you decide that was your race of my life? Was it something that was almost immediate, something that became apparent maybe a few years later as you were still racing, or something that you very recently thought about, or even when Kev sent you an email saying, do you want to come on the podcast? Like, when did it become apparent that that was the standout one for you?
It was when Kev sent me an email to ask me if I wanted to come on the podcast. And I never really thought about it. But when I thought, so when I took a minute to think about it again, actually, I saw Kev's email just before I got on the bike. And so I had a couple of hours of pedaling around the countryside to think about it. And that was the first one that jumped in my head. And then I tried to rationalize it and try to find other ones. But I kept coming back to that thinking, yeah, that was that one. And I think if I'd won 2009 Monaco, I would have picked that one. The fact that that day is tainted by the car breaking down and me drinking lots of tequila afterwards, basically bumped that further down.
Why tequila as well? Oh God, you'd felt awful the next day. Tequila really gets you, doesn't it? Or maybe you've got a higher tequila tolerance than I have.
It wasn't a pleasant day the next day. I won't lie.
Lovely. Well, Karun, honestly, thank you so much for coming on and doing a live Race of My Life with us. It's been an absolute pleasure to hear your memories and just to catch up ahead of a new Formula One season and everything. So yeah, so thank you very much for coming on Race of My Life, and Kev as well. Thank you. Thank you both. Do check out Karun's Race of My Life, 2008 GP2 feature race at Silverstone on autosport.com. And we'll be back soon with another podcast on Race of My Life.